From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The Limping Ghost by R. Chetwynd Hayes. Ronald Chetwynd Hayes is considered Britain's Prince of Chill and one of the most prolific writers of horror and ghost stories, with paperback sales alone in excess of 1 million copies. Two horror films, From Beyond the Grave in 1973 and The Monster Club of 1980, have been based on his collections. Mother said Brian was not to play with matches, and of course he did, setting light to the old summer house, so that Father had to put the fire out with a garden hose. Father maintained that Brian should be spanked, but Mother would not let him, stating with cool simplicity that words were more powerful than blows. "That's all very well," Father grumbled, "but one day..." "He's only 7," Mother pointed out, "and we must reason with him. It's not as though any real damage was done." Julia went out to look at the summer house, and truly the damage was negligible. The store steps slightly scorched, but this added to the old-world, time-beaten appearance of the ancient building. When she came back to the house, Mother was explaining to Brian the virtues and evils of fire. "The fire keeps us warm, it cooks our food, and is nice to look at." "Makes pretty pictures," Brian stated. "Lots of mountains and valleys." "Yes," Mother agreed, "and therefore fire is a good friend. But when you set light to the summer house, then it is a bad enemy. You, all of us, could have been burnt to death." "Death? Death?" Brian repeated the word with some satisfaction. "What is death?" Mother frowned, then proceeded to choose her words with care. "The body, your arms and legs become still, and you can't use your body anymore. You become like Mr. Miss One." Brian grinned with impish delight. "I'd like to be Mr. Miss One." Mother took the small boy into her arms and shook her beautiful head so that the fair curls danced like corn in sunlight. "No, my darling, no. You wouldn't like being Mr. Miss One." Julia came down late for dinner, for she had fallen asleep in her room and dreamt a strange dream. It seemed that she had been in the drawing room when Mr. Miss One entered. He had limped across the room and sat down beside her on the sofa, and for the first time he seemed to know she was present. He stared straight at her and looked so very, very sad that when she awoke, tears were rolling down her cheeks. "You look pale," Mother remarked, "and your eyes are red. I hope you aren't sickening for something." Julia said, "No," then seated herself opposite Brian, who made a face and poked his tongue out. "Behave yourself," Father warned. "And Julia, you're not to tease him." "I didn't," Julia began to protest, but Mother said, "You're not to answer your father back." She hung her head and fought back the scalding tears. The terrible injustice was a burning pain, and she felt shut out, unwanted. Brian was a child, a doll for her parents to pet. She was 16, tall, awkward, not particularly pretty, which meant being unloved, isolated, scolded, who knows, perhaps hated. "Julia, sit up," Mother continued with a sharp voice. "Don't slouch. Heavens above, when I was your age, I was as straight as a larch. Really, I can't imagine who you take after." "Listen to your mother," Father ordered, smiling at Brandon, whose mouth was smeared with custard. She is talking for your own good. They might have been talking to a stranger or casting words at a statue. Her very presence, every action provoked a series of stock phrases. She moved in her chair. Don't fidget, Mother snapped. For heaven's sake, sit still, said Father. Julia got up and ran from the room. Oh no, Mother exclaimed, not another fit of the sulks. She'll get over it, Father pronounced. The garden dozed under the afternoon sun, while bees and blue bottles hummed with contentment in the heat. Julia lay back in a deck chair and basked in the lake of misery, wallowing in the melancholy stream of her self-pity. I wish I could die. Death is like a beautiful woman in a gray robe who closes her eyes with gentle fingers, then wipes the slate of memory clean. She decided this was a noble thought, and really, she was quite definitely a genius, which explained why everyone was so unkind. I am different, she told herself, and at once felt much more cheerful. I think on a much higher plane. Mother's so stupid, afraid to smile in case she makes a line on her face. And as for Father, he's an echo, a nothing. Brian is a horrible, spoilt little beast, but I'm a genius. Having reached the satisfactory conclusion, she was about to rise when Mr. Miss One entered the garden. He was carrying a hoe, and walking over to one of the flower beds, he began to turn the soil, or rather gave the appearance of doing so, for Julia knew that not even a single stone would be disturbed. She crept up to him like a puppy approaching its master, uncertain of its reception. She stopped some 3 feet from him and sank down on the grass, gazing up into his face. He was so beautiful. There was no word to describe that kind, sensitive face. Mother was always a little frightened of Mr. Miss One, saying that though he appeared harmless, nevertheless he wasn't natural. Father regarded him in much the same way, as if he were a stray cat that refused to be dislodged. We must be mad to live in a house with a bally ghost, he had once protested. Never know what the damn thing is going to pop up. This attitude, of course, only confirmed their mundane, unimaginative outlook and showed up Julia's exceptional powers of perception. Mr. Miswin was beautiful, kind, and must have been long ago a remarkable person. Julia had no evidence to support this theory, for Mr. Miswin never spoke, was apparently oblivious of their presence, and only performed little non-productive chores, strolling aimlessly through the house or garden. Furthermore, Mr. Miswin was not young, possibly as old as Julia's father, for his black hair was flecked with gray, and there were tired lines around his eyes and mouth. But these signs of age enhanced his beauty, making him a strange, exciting figure combining the attributes of father and lover. Now he stood upright, leaning upon the hoe, and stared thoughtfully back at the house. Mr. Miswin, Julia whispered, who are you? I want to know so much. How long ago did you live? When did you die? And why do you haunt the house and garden? Haunt! That's a funny word. It sounds frightening. And you don't frighten me at all. Mr. Miswin returned to his work and continued to turn soil that never moved. Father says you don't exist, but are only a time image of someone who lived here years and years ago. That's nonsense. I could not fall in love with a shadow or dream about a patch of colored air. Julia, Mother was standing in the doorway and her voice held an angry, fearful tone. Julia, come here at once. Reluctantly, she rose and left Mr. Miswin to his ghostly gardening, willing herself not to look back. Mother slapped her bare arm, a punishment that had been applied in childhood. I've told you once, I've told you 1,000 times. You're not to go near that thing. It's not healthy. It ought to be exorcised or something. Exorcised, Julia corrected. And don't answer me back. I think sometimes you're a little mad. Go to your room and don't come down until I say so. From a bedroom window, Julia watched Mr. Miswin. He was pushing a ghostly lawnmower over the lawn, limping laboriously in its wake, seemingly oblivious that no grass leapt into the box, that the whirling blades made no sound. I expect he was killed in a war, Julia thought, as he disappeared behind a bush. She waited for him to reappear, but the garden remained empty. When apparently the setting sun sent long tree shadows across the grass, she knew, for the time being at least, the play was over. I thought we might run down to the coast today, Father announced over the breakfast table. Good idea, Mother nodded her agreement. Julia, sit up, child. Don't slouch. Listen to your mother, Father advised. Yes, a breath of sea air will do us all good. Brian will enjoy it, won't you, old fellow? Yes, Brian nodded vigorously. Throw stones at seagulls. Both fond parents laughed softly, and Mother admonished gently. You mustn't throw stones at dicky birds. Why? Because. For once, Mother seemed lost for an explanation, and it was left to Father to express an opinion. Because it's not nice. We won't go, Julia thought. We never go. Something will happen to stop us. But preparations went on after breakfast. Mother packed a hamper, and Brian produced a colored bucket and wooden spade from the attic, while Julia was instructed to brighten up and look cheerful for a change. Maybe we will go this time, she whispered, putting on her best summer dress with polka dots. Perhaps nothing will happen to stop us. The feeling of optimism grew as the entire family walked around the house to the garage, Father carrying the hamper, Mother fanning herself with a silk handkerchief, and Brian kicking the loose gravel. Father opened the garage door, took one step forward, and stopped. Damnation hell, he swore. This really is too much. Mr. Miswan was cleaning the car. A bright yellow duster whisked over the dust that remained undisturbed. White liquid from a green tin was sprayed on the bonnet, but somehow never reached its surface. Mr. Miswan rubbed the chromework vigorously, but there was no sign that his labor was to be rewarded. The dull bloom persisted, and at times he appeared to be polishing the empty space on either side of the bonnet, thereby suggesting to Julia's watchful eye that another and much larger car was the object of his ministrations. What the hell do we do? Asked Father. Well, Mother backed away. I, for one, am staying at home. Nothing on earth will get me in that car. Heavens knows he might come with us. We shouldn't allow it to dominate our lives, Father protested, but without much conviction. I mean to say, it's only a damn time image. Doesn't really exist, you know. Thank you very much, but it's got too much life for me. Mother began to walk back towards the house. Honestly, if you were any sort of man, you would get rid of it. What am I supposed to do? Father was almost running to keep up with her. I can't kick it. There's nothing solid for me to get to gripe with. I do think, my dear, that you're being a little unreasonable. Mother grunted, fanning herself vigorously. Then she turned on Julia. It's all your fault. You encourage it. I? Julia tried to defend herself, but a sense of guilt paralyzed her tongue. You ought to be ashamed, Father glared, wiping his forehead with his top pocket, never to be used handkerchief. You've no right to encourage it, spoiling our day out, upsetting your mother, and depriving your little brother of good sea air. Mother flopped down in a deck chair, where she continued to wave her handkerchief back and forth. Yesterday evening, I caught her at it, talking to it, she was, lying there on the grass and talking to it. She's mad. Heavens above knows who she takes after. Certainly my family were sane enough. I don't know what's to become of us. We could move, Father suggested. And to where? Mother sat up and put away her handkerchief. Who would buy a house with a ghost, an active ghost? And where would we get another house that's so secluded and off the beaten track? You know, I must have solitude, peace, and quiet. Perhaps it will go away, Father said after a short silence. They do, you know. The atmosphere sort of dispels after a bit. Not while that girl encourages it, Mother stated. Not while she moons around it like a lovesick puppy. Keep away from it, warned Father. Brian punched her thigh with a small fist. Keep away from it. Days passed without an appearance from Mr. Miswan. Julia wondered if her mother's anger had built a wall through which he could not pass, and mourned for him as though for a loved friend who had recently died. Sometimes, when she escaped from the vigilance of her parents, she went looking for him, roamed the gardens, or suddenly opened a door, hoping to see him leaning against the mantelpiece or lounging in a chair. But he had become a shadow that flees before sunlight. Even Father commented on his non-appearance. 6 days now and we haven't seen hair or hide of it. What did I tell you? The atmosphere has dispelled. Stuff and nonsense, Mother snapped. Atmosphere indeed. Lack of encouragement, more likely. I've been keeping an eye on someone I could touch with a very small stick. Three pairs of eyes were turned in Julia's direction, and she blushed. Brian kicked her ankle under the table. Keep away from it. I am of the opinion, Mother went on, that he must have been a bad character. I mean to say, respectable people don't go haunting places after they're dead. They go to wherever they're supposed to go and don't keep traipsing about, making a nuisance of themselves. He probably murdered someone and can't rest. No. All Judith's reticence, her lifelong submission to her parents' opinions, disappeared in a flood of righteous anger. A part of her looked on and listened with profound astonishment to the torrent of words that poured out of her mouth. He was not bad, I know it. He was sad, and that's why he walks. I know. Perhaps once he was happy here, or maybe it is sadness that chains him to this house, but he's not evil. He's not. You're bad, small, stupid, and you're driven him away. I'll never forgive you. Ever. Mother was so shocked that for a while she was incapable of speech. Father stared at the rebel with dilated eyes. Finally, Mother's tongue resumed its natural function. I always said the girl was mad, and at last I have proof. I feel quite faint. Heavens, did you see her eyes? Really, Henry, are you just going to sit there while she insults us? Do something! What? Yes, Father rose as though he were about to deliver a speech. That's no way to talk to your parents, particularly your mother. Oh, for heaven's sake, Mother pointed with dramatic emphasis towards the door. Get out. Go on. Go to your room, and I don't care if I never see your face again. But the earthquake was still erupting, and Julia shouted back, her brain a red cavern of pain. I hate you. Hate. Hate. Mother screamed and fell back in her chair, while Father so far forgot himself as to stamp his foot. How dare you speak to your mother like that? Go to your room. Remorse flooded her being, and she craved forgiveness like a soul in torment. I didn't mean it. Please. But Father had eyes and ears only for Mother, who was gasping and writhing in a most alarming fashion. Brian watched the ingrate with joyous excitement. Julia ran to her room. She flung herself face down the bed and sobbed soundlessly, her slender shoulders shaking, her long fingers clutching the bedclothes. Presently, the storm abated, and she became still. Her eyes opened, and her sixth sense sent out invisible fingers. All at once, she knew. She sat up and spun around. Mr. Miss One was standing in the recess by the side of the fireplace. As usual, he was busy, but it took some minutes for her to understand what he was doing. A hand drill. He appeared to be making holes in the wall, although, of course, the pink flower pattern wallpaper remained unmarked. Julia got up and walked cautiously towards him, joy blended with curiosity. He slipped little cylinders of fiber into the wall, then drove screws into the invisible holes. Light illuminated the darkness of Julia's ignorance. He's fitting a bookshelf. How sweet! She moved a little nearer so as to observe his actions with more clarity. His face was a study in concentration. The teeth were clenched, the muscles around the mouth taut, and once when the screwdriver slipped, the lips parted as though mouthing a silent curse. She spoke her thoughts aloud, even as a penitent unburdens his soul to an invisible priest. Mother is right. I shouldn't be thinking of you all the time. Look at you, fixing a shelf that probably moldered away years ago. If only I could talk to you, hear your voice most of all, make you realize I exist. Mr. Miss One lifted the formica-covered shelf and fitted it into the position It immediately disappeared, but he continued to work, seemingly content that all was well. You are more real to me than mother or father, and I feel I ought to tell you all manner of things. But there's no point when you ignore me. Is there no way I can reach you? Mr. Miswan took up a hammer and began to tap the wall. Julia moved one step nearer. She could see a small cut on his chin. You cut yourself shaving. How long ago did that happen? 10, 20, 30 years ago? Oh, you must know I am here. Can't you feel something? A coldness, an awareness? Surely there must be something, a certainty, that you are not alone. The urge to look back over your shoulder. Look at me. Look. Turn your head. You must. Must. The hammer struck Mr. Miswan's thumb and he swore. Blast! The solitary word exploded across the room and shattered the silence, making Julia shrink back. She retreated to the opposite wall, pressed her shoulders against its unrelenting surface, and watched him. He dropped the hammer, which fell to the floor with a resounding crash, sucked the afflicted thumb, then stared in Julia's direction. For a period of 5 seconds, he was a statue, a frozen effigy of a man. Then his mouth popped open. The hand dropped away, and his eyes were blue mirrors, reflecting astonishment, disbelief, fear. You can see me! Julia's joyous cry rang out, and she took 2 steps forward to find he had vanished. Man, hammer, plus the assortment of tools disappeared, and Julia was left banging her fist against the recess wall. Her voice rang out in a shriek of despair. Why? Why? Mother, father, even the carefully tutored Brian, treated her to the silence reserved for the outcast. Some speech was unavoidable, but this was delivered in an ice-coated voices with impeccable politeness. Will you kindly pass the salt, mother requested on one occasion, if it's not too much trouble. Father appeared to be applying the sanctions with some reluctance, but he was forced to obey a higher authority. More tea? His hand was on the teapot. Then he remembered his ordained line of conduct and pushed it towards her. Help yourself. Brian was more direct. I mustn't talk to you. This isolationist treatment created comfort when it was designed to produce misery. She was no longer the target for admonishing barbs, corrective slaps, or stinging words. She could fidget, sulk, slouch, or spend hours in her room without a single rebuke, although on occasion Mother was clearly sorely provoked, and once or twice her silence policy almost collapsed. Free from supervision, she was able to continue her pursuit of Mr. Miswan, but once again he seemed to have gone into hiding. The hum and roar of speeding cars drifted across the sleeping meadows. The roar of an overhead jet could be heard above the wind in the trees. Yet the living had no place in Julia's heart, or for that matter in any place in the house or garden. Of late, a dream had taken root in her imagination. Now it dominated her waking and sleeping life. The seed had first been sown when she saw Mr. Miswan cleaning his car. Suppose, whispered her imagination, you were to get into the car and let Mr. Miswan drive you out into the world. Let him rescue you, carry you off, and never, never come back. The voice of reason, a nasty insinuating whisper, interrupted with, but he is dead, a ghost. Reason was hoist by its own petard. If he is dead, if he is a ghost, then there is only one way in which I can join him. The twin daggers of shock and horror became blunt as the dream grew. It was a solution to all problems, the key to open the door to Mr. Miswan. She began to consider ways and means. Poison. She had no means of obtaining any. Cut her throat, slash her wrists. She shied from such grim prospects like a horse from a snake. Rope, hanging? That would be easy and should not be too painful. There was a length of plastic clothesline in the garage and a convenient beam. If she jumped from the car roof, the leap would be completed in the space of a single heartbeat. It was also very simple, and Julia wondered why she had not thought of it before. She began to make plans. From 2 to 4 o'clock in the afternoon would be best, for it was then that the family took their after-lunch nap. Mother undressed and went to bed. Father, weather permitting, stretched himself out in a garden hammock, or if wind or rain confined him to the house, he lay prostrate on the sitting room sofa. Brian slept anywhere. Like an animal, he shut off his consciousness wherever his elders set the example. Without doubt, the time to die was between 2 and 4 in the afternoon. The situation was somewhat complicated by Mother suddenly relaxing her rule of silence and making overtures for peace. She actually smiled and said sweetly, "Good morning, dear," before cracking her breakfast egg. "You're looking quite pretty this morning," she went on to remark an obvious untruth that suggested a desire to please. Julia was near despair. How could one die with an easy conscience when the enemy spiked their own guns and flew the white flag? Fortunately, Mother had a relapse with a cutting remark. "Prettiness without grace is like a wreath without flowers." And instantly Julia's resolve became a determination. She would die when the sun was high, take the fatal step in full daylight, and refuse to be diverted by smile or insult. However, she made one last effort to contact Mr. Miswan, creeping from room to room and searching the garden, praying that he might appear and acknowledge her existence with a smile, for she could not deny the unpalatable fact that on the one occasion when Mr. Miswan had seen her in the bedroom, his reaction had been one of fear. At least this established him as an intelligent personality instead of the mindless time image Father so glibly dismissed. But it was so, to say the least, a little disconcerting to know one's appearance inspired fear in a ghost. Of course, once she had assumed the same status, there would be no reason for him to fear her at all. Like would appeal to like, she waited with burning impatience for the hour of 2. At the lunch table, all signs indicated that normality had returned. "Don't slouch," ordered Mother. "Sit upright," Father chimed in. "Try to be more like your mother." Brian displayed signs of budding brilliance. "You're not pretty. You're not ugly. You're pretty ugly." The fond parent smiled. "He takes after me," pronounced Mother. "I could always turn a phrase." Julia's impatience to be gone grew and destroyed her last lingering doubts. Father had intended to take his nap in the garden, but just before 2 o'clock the first cold needles of rain began to fall, so he retreated to the sitting room and was soon prostrate on the sofa. Mother climbed the stairs, the bedroom door slammed, and Julia murmured an inaudible goodbye. Brian lay down on the dining room hearth rug and appeared to fall asleep, but Julia wondered if this was not a pretense put on for her benefit. Fortunately, the door had a key in the lock, so she turned it before leaving the house. A rising wind drove a curtain of rain across the lawn. It forced proud trees to bend their heads in submission and turned Julia's dress into a wet shroud. She ran for the garage, water splashing up her legs, dripping down her nose and chin, but it did not feel cold or even wet, and she marveled at the sense of well-being. The garage doors were open, and there was no time to consider why this was so, for there, standing in the gloomy interior, was a large red car. Julia stood within the entrance and stared at the stranger with wide-eyed astonishment. There should have been an ancient black family Austin. Instead, a sleek, rather vicious-looking red monster occupied the entire floor. A creation of highly polished red enamel, gleaming chromework, black tires, and bulging mudguards. It seemed to be a thing of latent power, just waiting for the right finger to touch a switch, to send it hurtling along straight roads across the barriers of time and space into a million tomorrows. The outside door was open, and Julia, her plans for self-destruction forgotten, slid onto the red plastic-covered seat and feasted her eyes on the complicated switchboard, the black steering wheel, the gleaming gear levels. Curiosity turned to wonderment, then ripened into pure joy. A ghost car. It must be, of course. This was the vehicle Mr. Miswan had been cleaning. Not only then, it was invisible, due undoubtedly to the base thoughts of Mother, Father, and that little beast, Brian. Now she could see it, feel it, and heavens be praised, actually smell it. This must be the result of suffering, loving him with all her being. She giggled, clasped her hands, and waited with joyous anticipation. Mr. Miswan entered the garage, limping, carrying a small overnight bag. He was plainly prepared for a journey. A terrible fear struck Julia. Please don't make it all disappear. Let me go with him wherever he goes, anywhere at all. He opened the right-hand door, slung his bag onto the back seat, then climbed in. He closed the door, turned the key on the switchboard, and the engine roared with instant pulsating life. Don't let it all disappear. Let me go with him. The car slid out of the garage, the garden and house swept by the windows, and Julia spared a thought for mother, father, and Brian, blissfully asleep, unaware that the despised one was passing out of their lives forever. It's happening. I'm going out at last. Oh, merciful God, going out. The main gates, new, glossy with black paint, were open, and Mr. Miswan swung the car out onto a country road. They were away at last, speeding along under an arcade of trees, flashing by meadows, snarling past lovely red-bricked houses, while windscreen wipers made neat half-moons in the driving rain. Mr. Miswan suddenly reached over and opened a narrow flap in the switchboard. His hand was a bare inch from Julia's breast, and she wanted to touch it, clasped the strong fingers, but was afraid that this wonderful dream might dispel. He took out a packet of cigarettes, adroitly popped one into his mouth, then replaced the carton and shut the flap. He lit the cigarette with a strange contraption from the switchboard, then inhaled, letting the smoke trickle down through his nose. By the time they had reached the main bypass, the novelty was wearing off, and Julia permitted herself a measure of confidence. The dream, if such it was, displayed no signs of breaking down. The car was solid. She could feel the seat beneath her, hear the muted roar of the engine, smell the smoke from Mr. Miswan's cigarette, see the road sliding away under the car wheels. The bypass was straight, a gray ribbon that stretched out into infinity as their speed built up. 60, 70, 80 miles an hour. Julia watched the needle climb on the speedometer. Then she turned her head and looked at Mr. Miswan. Poor ghost. Entirely oblivious in his ghost car, he did not know she was there. How was she to declare her presence and break through the wall that still separated them? She began to talk, spilling out her thoughts in a jumble of low-spoken words. Mr. Miswan, I'm sorry, I don't know your real name, but Brian, the horrible little beast, first called you Mr. Miswan because of your limp. You should have sort of missed a step. Please don't think it's meant unkindly, at least by me. In fact, the limp adds to your appearance, makes you more romantic. I guess that sounds silly, but I am silly. I can't help it. I've been in love with you ever since that day when you first walked across the dining room and Mother went screaming under the table. She did look funny. I remember you took something we couldn't see from the sideboard, then disappeared by the kitchen door. Can't you see, or at least hear me? It might have been imagination, but Mr. Miswan did appear to be a little uneasy. He slid down the window to throw away his half-consumed cigarette. Julia sighed. I wonder where we are going. Is this your world? Are the people out there wandering shadows left over from yesteryear, we wasting invisible through today? Please try to see me. She could see his left wrist. His jacket sleeve had slid down, and his wrist was bare. Sun-tanned, muscular, covered with fine hair, was also covered with goose pimples. She gasped, then gave a little cry. Oh, you're cold, my poor darling, you're cold. She had not meant to touch him, not yet, but there was no controlling the automatic impulse. Her hand flew to his wrist. For a brief moment, she touched warm flesh, actually felt the fast-beating pulse. Then the car swerved, and Mr. Miswan jerked his head around and stared straight at her. His face was a mask of pure, blood-chilling terror, and his mouth opened as he screamed. His hands clawed at the steering wheel as though some part of his brain was trying to right the skid, and the scream erupted into isolated words, like black rocks, crashing through a sheet of ice. Dead. Family. Burnt. Dead. 50 years. Dead. 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 The screech of tortured rubber mingled with the screaming words. Outside, the gray road was spinning round and round. A black shape came hurtling through the rain. There was a mighty soul uprooting crash, then for a brief second, nothing. A heartbeat of total oblivion. Julia was standing by the roadside, watching the car burn. Like a giant red beetle, it lay on its back, while beautiful scarlet flames rose from its corpse, like poppies from a long-filled grave. The red enamel bubbled and drooled down the seething metal, as blood tears from the eyes of a dying man. And somewhere in the heart of the shrieking inferno, something moved. Something flickered and ceased. Cars drew up, and the occupants climbed out, mouths open. Faces assumed expressions of horror, shock, or morbid excitement, but they were so many, silent, pathetic ghosts. Julia turned and walked away. Home was but a few steps away. Over the grass verge, through a hedge, under some trees, and there were the gates. Broken, rusty, one had lost a hinge and was reading like a drunken man. Once back in the gardens, sound returned. Birds sang, bees hummed, and the sun peeped through a broken cloud bank, making the rain-coated garden glisten like colored fragments. Julia opened the front door and made her way to the dining room. The family was seated round the table, which was laid for tea. "At last," exclaimed Mother. "I called you until my voice was hoarse. Honestly, I don't know who you think you are." "It's really too bad," Father echoed. "Your mother was nearly out of her mind. Where have you been?" Julia did not answer, but sank down, staring blankly at a tablecloth. Brian kicked her ankle. "You locked me in." "I ask you," Mother addressed the ceiling, "is that the action of a rational person? Locking your little brother in the dining room? Heavens above knows what might have happened. Well, don't just sit there. We are waiting for an explanation." "Answer your mother," Father instructed. Julia took a deep breath. "We're dead. All of us. Dead." The first shadows of night crept in through the long French windows, and the silence was coated with the dust of long dead time. Julia looked up. They were watching her with blank, pale faces. "Don't you understand? We're dead. We died 50 years ago in a fire. Brian did it. He set light to the bedroom curtains. The whole place went up in fire and smoke." The ticking of the mantelpiece clock seemed to grow louder. Brian stirred in his chair with a frantic denial. "I didn't." "You did!" Julia turned on him savagely. "You were told not to play with matches. It was you! You burnt us all to death!" "I didn't. I didn't." He hammered the table with a small clenched fist while tears ran down his cheeks, then rose and ran to Father, who put his arms around the shaking body. "Make her stop. I didn't. I didn't play with matches." "It's all right," Father whispered. "It's all right. Your sister isn't well." Mother could not speak, could only stare at Julia with wide open eyes. Occasionally she shook her head as though in disbelief. "Please," Julia pleaded, "try to understand. We are all dead. Mr. Miswan was the living. We were. We are ghosts." "Go to your room, dear." His father's voice was unexpectedly gentle. "Go to bed like a good girl. We'll look after you. Don't worry." "Yes," Mother spoke at last. "Please forgive me. I never knew. I'll never say a crossword again, ever." Julia rose very slowly, and as she did so, understanding exploded in her brain. "You think I'm mad." Mother shuddered, and Father shook his head firmly. "No, no, of course not, dear. Just tired, ill maybe, but not mad. Dear God, not mad." Julia fled before their naked terror, and as always took refuge in her room. She lay upon the bed and stared up at the ceiling, gradually allowing the veil to fall from the awful face of truth. She could never be happy again. She knew. Knowledge was brutal. Knowledge destroyed the comforting curtain of doubt. Father, clearly ill at ease, brought her some food on a tray, talked much too quickly of the healing virtues of sleep, plenty of good food, peace of mind, and departed. Julia heard the key turn in the lock. Presently, she sat by the window and watched the sun put the garden to bed. Shadows lengthened. Flowers folded their petals. Trees hung their heads, and the evening breeze went dancing across the lawn. For a while, there was a great healing peace. Then a dark shape limped up the drive. At first, Julia thought it might be Father, but as it drew nearer, she saw the black, charred face. The hands were shriveled, twisted patches of white bone gleamed through the gaping, toasted flesh. Eyes still glittered in the naked skull, and they stared up at Julia's window. Julia tried to scream, but her vocal cords refused to function. The most she could make was a hoarse croaking sound. But out of the heart of all her demanding terror, a single rational thought ran across her brain like a ribbon of fire. Is this how I appear to him? All that remained of Mr. Miswan limped up the front steps and disappeared from view. Julia knew her prayer had been answered. She would never be parted from him again.